Welcome to the Kentucky Building Materials Association podcast. What if I told you that an employee handing you a state-issued medical cannabis card, you know, the very document that supposedly grants them legal permission to use a controlled substance, is actually the exact document that gives you the absolute legal authority to terminate their employment?
I mean, it sounds completely counterintuitive when you put it like that.
Right, because we are so conditioned to think that the word medical automatically triggers this cascade of workplace protections, accommodations, and, well, just endless legal red tape.
Yeah, it really is the ultimate legal paradox for business owners right now.
Yeah.
You hear that a state has legalized medical cannabis like Kentucky has done with Senate Bill 47, and the immediate reaction from anyone running a commercial operation is just sheer panic.
Oh, absolutely. Total panic.
Because you assume your right to manage your own facility has just been severely compromised. You envision the scenario where your hands are tied while some impaired employee climbs right into the cab of a front-end loader.
And that is literally the nightmare scenario for our listeners today. The lumber dealers, the general managers, the owners who make up the KBMA. I mean, you're running a yard with suspended loads, high RPM blades, massive diesel equipment.
Yeah, the environment is inherently dangerous.
Exactly. The thought of state-mandated impairment in that specific environment is terrifying. But that is exactly why we are taking this deep dive today. Because we aren't here to give you a warning about some new regulatory nightmare. We are actually here to hand you a shield.
And that shield is incredibly robust. Our source material today is a comprehensive white paper produced specifically for KBMA members. It's titled Medical Cannabis in Kentucky Employer Implications.
And this was put together specifically for the members, right?
Yeah, it was commissioned to dissect this exact new legal landscape. And I have to say, the findings are profound. The legislation was crafted in a way that deliberately, and I mean explicitly, preserves your absolute authority to maintain a completely safe, zero-tolerance, drug-free workplace.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to truly grasp the leverage you have as an employer under this new framework, we have to look at the baseline first. We need to understand the mechanics of Senate Bill 47 itself.
Right. So on the surface, the headline is simple. You know, medicinal cannabis is now legal for qualified patients in Kentucky.
Right. But there's a massive hidden mechanism in how that law was actually written, isn't there?
There is. The mechanism is this deliberate separation of spheres. The state legislature essentially drew a hard, fast boundary line right at your property line.
Meaning the business property line.
Exactly. SB 47, which is codified in KRS Chapter 218A, it opens the door for a patient and their doctor to explore cannabis as a treatment in their private lives.
Yeah.
But the law specifically dictates that this private medical authorization does not cross over into the commercial sphere.
Wow. Okay, so
the authorization to consume a substance for medical reasons basically does not override the fundamental physics, the liability, or the safety requirements of your specific workplace.
So having a medical cannabis card under this law is essentially like having a legitimate doctor-issued prescription for a heavy narcotic, say like a strong muscle relaxer or an opioid painkiller.
That's a really good way to look at it.
Like you acquired it legally, right?
Yeah.
A medical professional told you to take it. But that private medical interaction doesn't magically grant you the constitutional right to clock in, walk onto a commercial lumber yard, and start operating a multi-directional forklift while under its influence.
Exactly. That analogy hits the absolute core of the legal reality here. The state recognized that a doctor's recommendation is not a license to introduce a recognized hazard into an industrial environment.
Which is a huge relief for a lumberyard.
Massive relief. The fundamental takeaway from the KBMA's analysis is that the law does not require you to hire, to accommodate, or to retain any employee who uses medical cannabis.
Wait, even if they have the card?
That holds entirely true, even if they're standing right in your office holding a perfectly valid state-issued medical card. The card protects them from state criminal prosecution. It does not protect their job.
I want to push on that concept of accommodation for a second because, you know, in the realm of human resources, that is a heavily weaponized word.
Oh, yeah. HR departments lose sleep over that word.
Right. Usually, if an employee comes to you with a documented medical condition, let's say they have severe chronic back pain, the Americans with Disabilities Act and just standard employment law forces the employer into this whole interactive process.
Right. You have to sit down and figure out a reasonable accommodation.
Yeah. Maybe that's a different chair or a modified lifting requirement or, you know, more frequent breaks.
And that interactive process is usually mandatory. failing to engage in it is like the prime trigger for workplace litigation.
Yeah.
But this is where the legislative mechanics of SB 47 offer a massive advantage to the business owner.
How so?
Because the law explicitly severs cannabis from that accommodation process entirely.
Yeah.
You are not legally obligated to permit the use of cannabis on your property.
Not at all?
Not at all. You are not even obligated to allow possession of it, meaning they cannot even keep it in their locker or in their personal vehicle parked on your lot.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize it extended to the parking lot.
It does. And most importantly, you have zero obligation to accommodate any level of impairment while they are on the clock.
So if that employee with the chronic back pain comes to the yard manager and says, look, I have my state card. I just need to take a quick 15-minute break in my truck to use my medicine so I can physically finish my shift pulling treated lumber.
Right.
The manager doesn't have to negotiate that. They don't have to call HR and try to find some kind of middle ground.
There is no middle ground required. The legal obligation to accommodate that specific request is absolute zero. The concept of accommodation, as we traditionally understand it in employment law, simply does not apply to cannabis use in your workplace under this specific statute.
Which naturally brings us to the operational reality of testing. I mean, if we don't have to accommodate it, how do we actually police it?
Right. Testing is the next logical step.
Because I know a lot of KBMA members who were terrified they'd have to rewrite their entire employee handbook or water down their drug policies or create some kind of convoluted special exception section just for cardholders?
Well, the white paper analysis points out quite clearly that drug-free workplace policies are fully protected.
Fully protected. No carve-outs.
They are completely protected, and the mechanisms for enforcement remain entirely intact.
Yeah.
You can maintain strict zero-tolerance policies. The law explicitly permits employers to continue using all their standard testing protocols.
So pre-employment screening.
Yes. Random drug testing programs.
Yes.
And post-accident testing. None of those tools have been compromised or restricted by SB 47.
Okay, let's run a real-world scenario on that, just to be crystal clear. Let's say you're a dealer and you're trying to staff up for the busy spring building season.
A classic situation.
Yeah. A guy comes in, interviews incredibly well, knows the difference between LVL and Glillum. He's got trust plan experience. I mean, he's basically a unicorn hire.
Right. You want this guy on the yard yesterday.
Exactly. So you send him for the standard pre-employment drug screen, and he pops positive for marijuana. He comes back, immediately produces his state-issued medical card, and says, hey, it's legal, my doctor prescribed it. What actually happens next?
Well, under the protections outlined in the KBMA analysis, you simply tell him that your company maintains a zero-tolerance policy, and you decline to hire him.
Just like that.
Just like that. The positive test is an absolute, legally sound basis for refusing employment. The medical card does not act as a shield against your established hiring standards.
Okay, but what about the existing workforce? Because that's where I think the friction really is. Let's talk about the dreaded weekend use argument.
Ah, yes. The weekend use debate.
Right. An employee goes home on Friday, uses their medical cannabis over the weekend, comes to work on Tuesday, and you pull their name for a random drug screen. Or worse, a forklift clips a cantilever rack on Tuesday afternoon, you do a mandatory post-accident test, and they pop positive.
And they are going to swear up and down they weren't impaired at the moment of the test of the accident, right? They'll say they just used it legally days ago.
Exactly. And that is the most common friction point we see in this area of law.
It is. And it stems from a scientific reality, honestly. Currently, we just lack a reliable, commercially available testing mechanism to prove real-time impairment for THC, you know, the way a breathalyzer proves real-time impairment for alcohol.
Because it stays in your system for so long.
Exactly. THC metabolites store in the fat cells, and they can trigger a positive test days or even weeks after the psychoactive effects have worn off.
So the employee argues, look, you're firing me for something I did legally on my own time just because your test can't prove I was actually high on the job. I mean, that sounds like a lawsuit waiting to happen.
It really would be if the legislature hadn't anticipated that exact scientific limitation. Because employers cannot definitively prove real-time impairment via a chemical test, the law actually allows you to rely on the positive test result as a proxy for a policy violation.
Wait, explain that. A proxy for a policy violation.
Yeah, so if your policy dictates a drug-free workplace and the employee produces a test showing the presence of the substance, they have violated the policy, period.
Oh, I see.
The law supports your right to terminate based on that positive test alone, regardless of the employee's claims about when they consumed it or whether they actually felt impaired at the time of the accident. The zero-tolerance policy is respected as a legitimate safety mechanism.
And that leads directly into what might be the single most valuable legal protection in this entire discussion. You fire the guy for the positive test. The natural fear for any independent lumber dealer is the retaliatory lawsuit.
The wrongful termination suit.
Right, because even if you win, a wrongful termination suit can cost a business tens of thousands of dollars in legal fees just to get through the discovery phase. Small and medium-sized businesses often settle these frivolous lawsuits just to stop the bleeding.
Yeah, it's a huge financial drain. Mm-hmm. But the authors of the KBMA white paper recognize that threat, and they highlighted how SB 47 neutralizes it.
How does it neutralize it?
The statute deliberately blocks these specific types of lawsuits. It explicitly states that the law creates no cause of action for wrongful discharge and no cause of action for discrimination based solely on an individual's status as a medical cannabis cardholder.
Okay, let's translate no cause of action for our members, because that is a very specific legal barrier. It essentially means the courthouse door is locked before the plaintiff even gets to the steps, doesn't it?
Precisely. If a terminated employee goes to an employment attorney and says, hey, my boss fired me because of a medical cannabis card, I want to sue for discrimination, that attorney is going to look at the text of SB 47.
And what are they going to find?
They will have to inform the former employee that there is absolutely no statutory basis to bring the suit. A judge would look at the complaint and dismiss it immediately because the law itself says you cannot sue an employer for this specific reason.
Wow. It just completely removes the leverage of extortion by litigation.
It does. It's a massive shield.
That is massive peace of mind. But let's look at the physical justification for why the state granted employers this kind of immunity. Because we aren't talking about a dispute in a carpeted accounting firm where the biggest risk of impairment is a miscalculated spreadsheet.
No, not at all.
We are talking about the building materials sector.
And the operational reality of your industry is the ultimate justification for these strict policies. Mm-hmm. The analysis specifically points to the protections granted for safety-sensitive work.
Safety-sensitive work.
Yes. Employers are legally empowered to restrict or entirely prohibit employees from operating equipment, machinery, and power tools if cannabis use presents an unreasonable safety risk.
And in a lumber yard, practically the entire footprint of the facility is an unreasonable safety risk if someone's cognitive function is compromised.
Absolutely.
Let's really paint that picture for a second. You have a yard guy operating a 10,000-pound capacity forklift. He's trying to extract a 20-foot bunk of engineered I-joists from the top tier of a rack system.
A very standard Tuesday morning.
Right. And at the exact same time, a flatbed delivery truck is backing into the loading zone, a contractor is walking across the yard looking for his order, and a panel saw is screaming in the mill workshop nearby. The spatial awareness required in that moment is immense.
It's a highly dynamic environment.
You need peripheral vision, depth perception, and split-second reaction times just to get through the day without a fatality.
When you lay out the environmental hazards like that, it becomes incredibly obvious why the law refuses to mandate accommodations. A fractional delay in reaction time in that environment doesn't result in a minor mistake.
No, it results in a catastrophic injury.
No.
Or worse.
Exactly. The law recognizes that the employer must have the ultimate authority to look at that forklift, look at that radial arm saw, and declare that absolutely no one touches those controls unless they are completely clear-headed. Safety eclipses the individual's medical treatment preference.
Which brings up a fascinating operational challenge, because we established earlier that chemical testing for THC doesn't prove real-time impairment.
Right, it just proves recent use.
So, if a yard manager is out on the floor, amidst all that chaos with the forklifts and the flatbeds, how do they actually make the call that someone is impaired right now, in the moment, before an accident happens?
Well, the law provides two avenues for an employer to determine impairment. We've discussed drug testing, which serves as the post-incident or policy enforcement tool.
Right.
The other avenue is behavioral observation.
But behavioral observation is incredibly subjective. I mean, you're asking a yard manager, who is likely not a trained medical professional, to diagnose impairment based on how a guy is walking or talking.
It is subjective, and honestly, that subjectivity is historically a massive liability for employers. Normally, if a manager accuses an employee of being impaired, sends them home, or fires them based purely on observation,
the employer has to prove it, right?
Exactly. The employer bears the burden of proving that impairment in a subsequent dispute. But SB 47 introduces a radical legal mechanism here. the burden shift.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because I like to think of this as the instant replay challenge in sports.
Oh. That's a great analogy. Let's hear it.
So in a football game, the referee makes a call on the field. If a coach challenges it, the burden of proof isn't on the referee to prove he was right. The burden is on the coach to provide indisputable video evidence that the referee was wrong.
Right.
If the video is inconclusive, the original call on the field stands. Is that essentially how this burden shift works?
That is a phenomenal way to visualize it, yes. Under this legislation, the employer is the referee making the call on the field.
Okay.
If an employer determines an employee is impaired based on observable behaviors, you know, things like slurred speech, an unsteady gait, drastically delayed reactions, or even just the physical smell of the substance, they make the call to remove that person from the safety-sensitive environment.
And if the employee challenges that decision, let's say they file a grievance or attempt a wrongful termination claim, arguing they were just tired or they had a cold and the manager was just out to get them.
The statute dictates that the burden shifts entirely to the employee. The employee must now climb the hill and produce concrete evidence proving they were not impaired.
Wow.
Think about the power of that dynamic. The state inherently trusts the business owner's assessment of their own facility safety standards more than it wants to micromanage the dispute.
That is a staggering level of state-level protection. The employer gets the benefit of the doubt by default.
Yes. It allows for the immediate mitigation of a hazard without the paralyzing fear of having to defend a subjective observation in court months later.
But for KBMA members, state law is really only half the equation, isn't it? I mean, lumber dealers operate in an industry heavily regulated by federal agencies.
Oh, absolutely. And federal law doesn't always play nicely with state initiatives, especially regarding controlled substances.
Because the friction between state and federal law is really the crux of the issue here. Even if Kentucky had written a disastrous bill that forced employers to accommodate impairment, which, as we've detailed, they did not, the KBMA white paper outlines an entire secondary shield.
Right, the federal overlay.
Yeah. And the most prominent shadow cast over any building materials operation is, without question, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration.
OSHA. Just the acronym is enough to raise the blood pressure of any general manager.
I know it raises mine. And the specific tool OSHA uses that terrifies people the most is the General Duty Clause. Can we break that down?
Sure. The General Duty Clause is the ultimate catch-all regulation. It mandates that employers must provide a workplace free from recognized hazards that are causing or are likely to cause death or serious physical harm.
So it's basically a blanket rule for safety.
Exactly. OSHA uses this clause when there isn't a highly specific, hyper-technical standard for a particular hazard, but the hazard is universally acknowledged by the industry.
So let's connect the dots between the General Duty Clause and medical cannabis. Is an employee whose cognitive function or reaction time is slowed by marijuana considered a recognized hazard?
Unequivocally. Allowing an impaired employee to operate the heavy equipment we just discussed doesn't just constitute a lapse in judgment. It is a direct violation of the General Duty Clause.
So it's the ultimate trump card.
It is. If a yard worker drops a load of drywall on a contractor's truck and OSHA arrives to investigate the incident.
Let me stop you right there because this is where the rubber meets the road.
Okay.
OSHA shows up. They ask for the post-accident drug test results of the forklift operator. The test is positive for THC. The operator pulls out his Kentucky medical cannabis card and says, look, it's legal. What does the federal OSHA inspector say to that?
The OSHA inspector completely ignores the state medical card.
Wait, really? They just ignore it entirely?
Yeah, completely ignore it. Federal law does not recognize it. To OSHA, you, the employer, knowingly allowed an employee with a controlled substance in their system to operate heavy machinery.
Oh, man.
You failed to protect the workplace from a recognized hazard. You will be cited under the General Duty Clause, and the fines and legal exposure can be devastating.
So, maintaining a strict zero-tolerance drug policy isn't just a right granted by the state. It is an absolute mandate dictated by federal safety compliance.
Yes. You literally cannot run a compliant lumber yard without enforcing sobriety.
The analysis is crystal clear on this point. Strict drug policies are not only permitted, they are a fundamental necessity for compliance. But OSHA is only the first of four federal overlays we need to examine, right?
Right. The second is the bedrock of federal drug policy.
Yeah.
The Controlled Substances Act, or the CSA.
And the CSA is where the concept of federal supremacy really rears its head, isn't it? Because state legislatures can pass all the medical cannabis bills they want, but the federal government has a completely different classification system.
Exactly. Under the CSA, marijuana remains classified as a Schedule I controlled substance.
And what does that mean, legally speaking?
The legal definition of a Schedule I drug is a substance with a high potential for abuse and no currently accepted medical use in treatment in the United States.
No accepted medical use. So the federal government stance is essentially that the Kentucky medical card is authorizing something that medically doesn't even exist.
That's precisely it. Because it is schedule-y federally, there is absolutely no federal mandate to accommodate its use. State law cannot compel a private business to violate federal drug classifications or harbor the use of a federally illegal substance on commercial property.
This brings up an interesting complication for a lot of KBMA members. Because many lumber dealers don't just sell to local custom home builders, right? They supply materials for federal projects.
Oh, yeah. That's a huge part of the business.
They deliver to military bases, they provide materials for federally funded low-income housing initiatives, or they work on federal infrastructure grants.
And that triggers the third federal overlay, the Drug-Free Workplace Act.
Okay, tell me about that one.
If your business acts as a federal contractor or receives federal grants, you don't have a choice in this matter. You are explicitly required by federal law to establish and maintain a drug-free workplace policy.
So it's a contractual trap.
It is. If you decide to be lenient, or if you decide you want to accommodate a medical cardholder because, you know, they are a great employee, you are actively violating the terms of your federal contracts.
And you risk losing those contracts entirely.
Exactly. The Drug-Free Workplace Act reinforces your authority to prohibit cannabis use, but it also transforms that authority into a strict obligation. If you want federal money flowing into your business, you must maintain zero tolerance.
Okay, we've covered OSHA, the Controlled Substances Act, and the Drug-Free Workplace Act. There is a fourth federal overlap that always seems to cause confusion for HR departments.
Yes, the Americans with Disabilities Act. The ADA.
The ADA is incredibly complex, and it creates a very specific legal friction point here. Many employees, and frankly, many employers, assume that because an individual has a medical condition severe enough to qualify for a cannabis card, the ADA automatically swoops in to protect them.
Right. Let's say they have epilepsy or severe rheumatoid arthritis. The logic goes that the ADA will force an accommodation.
Right. The logic goes. Arthritis is a recognized disability under the ADA. Cannabis is the treatment for the arthritis. Therefore, the employer has to accommodate the cannabis use to comply with the ADA. Where does that logic break down?
It breaks down at the definition of legal treatment. The ADA provides sweeping protections for employees with disabilities, but it contains a very specific carve-out. It does not protect the illegal use of drugs.
Ah, and because of the Controlled Substances Act.
Marijuana is a Schedule I illegal drug federally.
Precisely. So even if the underlying medical condition is a perfectly documented, recognized disability under the ADA,
the chosen treatment of that condition with a Schedule I substance nullifies the protection. An employer is never required by the ADA to accommodate the use of a federally illegal drug, regardless of what the state medical board authorizes.
Wow.
What's fascinating here is how the federal classification creates an impenetrable wall that state law simply cannot breach.
You know, the alignment here is actually quite beautiful from an employer's perspective.
It really is.
You have state law SB 47 saying, we grant you the absolute right to enforce your safety policies without fear of discrimination suits. And then you have the entire weight of the federal government, OSHA, the CSA, the ABA, saying, you actually must enforce those policies if you want to avoid massive federal liability.
It's an airtight legal environment. It is a rare moment of profound clarity in employment law. The state and federal frameworks are not competing, they are compounding.
They both point the business owner in the exact same direction.
Exactly. Prioritize the physical safety of your operation, maintain your established policies, and do not compromise your operational integrity for a state-level medical experiment.
So we spent a lot of time in the realm of legal theory, analyzing state statutes and federal clauses. Let's bring this directly down to the dirt and sawdust of the listener's daily life.
Let's do it.
The white paper spends significant time synthesizing these laws, specifically for the building materials and lumber sector. Because let's face it, running a lumber yard is not like running a retail clothing store. The stakes are fundamentally different.
The stakes are life and death. And the KBMA analysis explicitly recognizes that. It identifies three major operational realities for your members.
Which are?
The reliance on heavy machinery, severe material handling risks, and the constant presence of OSHA regulations.
We touched on this earlier, but let's really explore the material handling risks. A lumberyard is essentially an environment where incredibly heavy, awkward objects are constantly in motion, often right above people's heads.
Yes, it's organized chaos.
You are dealing with bunks of wet-treated lumber that can weigh several tons. You are dealing with long spans of composite decking that act like sails in the wind when they are on a forklift.
And you're loading these materials onto flatbed trucks, securing them with straps, sending them out onto public highways.
The potential for a catastrophic failure is ever present.
And because of those deeply documented, undeniable hazards, the analysis draws a very firm result for the industry. Because you operate in this specific high-risk sector, KBMA members retain full, unassailable discretion to execute three vital actions.
Okay, let's hear the three actions.
One. You can decline to hire any applicant who holds a medical cannabis card or test positive. 2. You can enforce blanket zero-tolerance drug policies across every department in your company. And 3. You can terminate any employee for a positive drug test, regardless of their cardholder status or claims of off-duty use.
So what does this all mean for the owner sitting in their office right now? It means that the inherent nature of your business is your greatest legal defense.
Exactly. You aren't being a rigid, old-school boss by enforcing these rules.
Yeah.
You aren't being discriminatory.
You are fulfilling a fundamental moral and legal obligation to preserve life and limb. The margin for error in a lumberyard is practically zero. Therefore, the tolerance for cognitive impairment must also be zero.
It is a non-negotiable life safety imperative. And both the state legislature and the federal government have provided you with the total legal backing to enforce that imperative.
Which brings us to the most critical part of this deep dive. We've established that you have this immense legal power, and we've established that you have the moral and operational justification to use it. But power is useless if you don't know how to deploy it.
Right. Execution is everything.
How do you actually put this legal theory into practice on Monday morning? Let's get into the playbook.
The white paper concludes with a bottom-line assessment and a series of highly actionable recommendations. The foundational premise, which we must reiterate, is that while medical cannabis is legal for patients in Kentucky, it is completely unprotected in the workplace.
Unprotected. Okay.
Therefore, KBMA members must take proactive steps to operationalize their rights.
Step one in the playbook. Review and update your written drug-free workplace policies. This seems obvious, but I guarantee there are dealers out there right now operating on an employee handbook they downloaded from the internet in, like, 2012.
Oh, without a doubt. And an outdated handbook is a massive liability trap.
Yeah.
You cannot rely on legacy policies when the state law has fundamentally shifted.
So what should they do?
Your written policy needs to be reviewed by counsel, and it needs to specifically address the current landscape. It must explicitly state that despite the passage of Kentucky SB 47 regarding medical cannabis, the company maintains a strict zero-tolerance policy.
For use, possession, and impairment.
Exactly. And that this policy applies equally to all employees, regardless of any state-issued medical cardholder status. The language must be totally unambiguous.
Step two. Clearly communicate these zero-tolerance or safety-based standards to all employees. Because having an airtight policy hidden in a PDF on the company internet doesn't do you any good if nobody knows it exists.
Communication is the armor that protects the policy. You need to pull this document out of the shadows.
So, like, toolbox talks.
Yes, initiating toolbox talks specifically on this subject, bringing it up in morning safety huddles. Most importantly, it means having every single employee physically sign a document acknowledging that they have read, understood, and agreed to the updated zero-tolerance policy.
You are trying to systematically eliminate the phrase, "I didn't know," from your workplace?
Exactly. Because if a guy tests positive and tries to claim he thought his state card protected him, you need to be able to pull that signed acknowledgement out of his personnel file.
And prove he was fully educated on the standard.
Documentation is your primary defense against a wrongful termination claim.
And then we arrive at step three. And honestly, this is the one that trips up 90% of businesses. Step three. Ensure consistent enforcement to reduce liability risk. Let's talk about the danger of playing favorites, because in a tight labor market, this is a massive temptation.
It's the biggest trap there is.
Let's create a scenario. You have a guy on the yard. Let's call him Dave.
Okay, Dave.
Dave has been running the big front-end loader for 15 years. He has never had a safety incident. He shows up early. He knows exactly how to load a truck to maximize the payload without blowing out the axles. He's your best guy.
A highly valuable asset to the company. Hard to replace.
Right. So So the company does a random quarterly drug screen. Dave's number comes up, and he pops positive for THC. He comes into the office, looks at the floor, and hands the manager a medical cannabis card.
Okay.
He says his knees are shot from climbing in and out of the cab for a decade, and his doctor gave him the card to help him sleep at night.
A very sympathetic story.
Yeah. And the yard manager looks at the schedule. They are entering the busiest month of the year. They are short-staffed. Replacing Dave will be a nightmare. The manager thinks, I know Dave isn't high on the job. I'm just going to give him a written warning and let him get back to work.
From an operational standpoint, in that exact moment, the manager thinks they are making a pragmatic decision to save the busy season.
Right. But from a legal standpoint.
From a legal liability standpoint,
right?
They have just detonated a bomb under the company's legal protections.
Why? Because they didn't fire him.
Because they established a precedent of selective enforcement.
Hmm.
Let's look at what happens next in your scenario. 2 weeks later, the company hires a brand new yard worker. He takes his pre-employment drug screen, pops positive for THC, and produces his own medical card. Following the written policy, the company immediately declines to hire him.
And now the new guy gets angry, hires a lawyer, and files a discrimination lawsuit.
And that lawyer is going to depose your yard manager. The lawyer will discover that you retained a 15-year veteran who tested positive with a medical card, but you refused to hire a new applicant who tested positive with a medical card.
Oh, I see where this is going.
The lawyer will argue, you clearly do not have a bona fide safety policy because you ignored it for Dave. You enforced the policy selectively. Therefore, you didn't refuse to hire my client because of safety. You used the drug test as a pretext to discriminate against him for some other illegal reason.
You completely lose the protection of the safety policy because you proved it wasn't actually a hard rule. You pierced your own legal armor.
Inconsistent enforcement is the fastest way to invite the exact lawsuits the state statute was designed to prevent. If your policy is zero tolerance, it must be zero tolerance for the 15-year veteran loader operator and the 19-year-old kid who walked in the door yesterday to sweep up sawdust.
No exceptions.
None. If you make exceptions based on talent or tenure, you are legally admitting that the rule is not a critical safety imperative. Consistency is the vital glue that holds all of these legal protections together.
So, speaking directly to you, the KBMA member listening to this, doing the administrative work today, reviewing your handbook, having your lawyer tighten the language, running the toolbox talks, and fundamentally training your management team to enforce the rules without a motion or exception that is the cheapest, most effective insurance policy you can possibly buy.
Absolutely is.
It protects you against a catastrophic physical accident on the yard tomorrow, and it protects you against a financially draining lawsuit the day after. It requires operational discipline, but the law has completely cleared the path for you to do it.
The state legislature and the federal government have handed you an incredibly comprehensive set of tools here. You are not a victim of changing medical legislation. You are entirely in control of your facility. It is simply a matter of having the discipline to implement and enforce those tools correctly.
Let's bring this whole deep dive home. We have covered an immense amount of ground today. We started by looking into the mechanics of Kentucky Senate Bill 47, and we uncovered that despite the anxiety surrounding medical cannabis legalization, this law is actually a profoundly positive development for KBMA members.
It manages to strike a very specific balance. It legalizes medical use for patients who legitimately need it in the privacy of their own homes, but it simultaneously constructs a massive, impenetrable legal fortress around your commercial operations.
It gives you the explicit legal right to prioritize the safety of your yard above all else. It allows you to enforce strict zero-tolerance drug policies. It aligns perfectly with your mandates to maintain OSHA compliance.
And crucially, it accomplishes all of this while expressly blocking disgruntled employees from dragging you into court for discrimination based on their status as a cardholder.
You have the total authority to run a safe, secure, drug-free lumber yard.
This raises an important question, however, and it's something I want every listener to deeply consider as they walk out onto their yard this week.
What's that?
We spend a lot of time discussing the incredible power of the burden shift. The legal reality that if an employer subjectively observes impairment, the employee must prove they were sober.
Right.
But as a business owner or general manager, how exactly are you training your floor supervisors to define and document that behavioral observation in real time.
No, that's a great point.
Amidst the roaring diesel engines, the dust, and the sheer chaos of a busy dispatch morning, do your foremen know exactly what physical signs to look for? And more importantly, do they know exactly how to write that incident report to ensure the legal protection actually holds up when challenged?
That is a phenomenal challenge to leave them with. Having a legal shield forged by the state legislature is wonderful, but if the troops on the ground don't know how to raise it when the pressure is on, it doesn't do you any good.
Exactly. Evaluating your internal training mechanisms and how your managers document incidents on the floor is the critical next step.
Well, we started this deep dive talking about the anxiety of stepping into the murky fog of changing medical legislation. Hopefully, dissecting this KBMA white paper has acted as a lighthouse cutting through that fog.
I hope so, too.
The medical landscape regarding cannabis might be rapidly evolving, but the legal boundary lines securing the safety of your lumberyard have never been drawn more clearly or more strongly in your favor. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the KBMA white paper. We wish you a safe, highly productive, and completely hazard-free week out there on the yard.